CEOs, they are having a blast while the working poor trying to make a paycheck last. The bailout money is created with new debt while they're rolling in the nimble as private jets. All the workers on the street just dripping sweat. White collar hustlers are taking everything they can get. They put the nation on a hyperinflation track. No presidential administration can take it back. And now the taxpayers picking up the slack. Like they put a high dollar big brother monkey on your back. I want my bailout money. Sweet green.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Justin Wolfers, a visiting professor at Princeton University and a professor in the Business and Public Policy Department at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. He is the co-editor of the Brookings Papers on Economic Activity, and he has an article at Freakonomics, The Secret Consensus Among Economists, and an article at Bloomberg with his wife, economist Betsy Stevenson, The U.S. Economic Policy Debate is a Sham. Welcome to Background Briefing, Justin Wolfers.
A pleasure to be here, Ian.
And why is it a sham? I mean, the study that's just come out by the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business apparently involves 40 of the country's leading economists across the political spectrum. So that's what we're talking about, the study that this independent group of economists has come up with.
Yeah, so the sham here is really the disjunction between modern economic thinking. And you can say a lot of things about economists. We get things wrong. We argue a lot. But there's also a whole lot of things we agree on. And there's an enormous disjunction between that and the current state of our economic policy debate in the United States. There's a huge range of issues where there's very violent public debates among folks running for re-election, whereas received wisdom or expert opinion, for what it's worth, seems to be fairly well united that, in a range of areas, that the bailout, for instance, was helped lower unemployment, that the stimulus helped lower unemployment, the worst of the nonsense we hear, things like Obama is responsible for high gas prices. It's a crazy idea. Gas prices are determined by supply and demand in global markets. And it's that difference between the debate that's going on in Washington and what we economists think we've actually learned.
Well, one of the problems I think that obscures the debate is the problem that we have with the media in general, this binary notion of every argument has an equal and opposite argument, the pro, con, and then the kind of meaningless mush. And for example, when the Republicans threatened the full faith and credit of the United States and threatened to shut down the government, that was basically covered as a he said, she said situation. So do you think that that's the problem here, that if you have, which I take it this study has revealed, is that most of the ignorance about economics is being propagated by the Republicans?
That's absolutely true. I mean, your example of the debt ceiling debate was really a splendid one. There's no economist in the entire United States who thinks that holding the full faith and credit of the federal government up for ransom is a good idea. It's going to hurt our credit rating in the longer run, and it looks like it may even have hurt the U.S. economy as it was happening. It really undermines people's confidence. And so there are these cases where there are views that are simply indefensible, maybe too hard, but there's certainly no defense coming from expert economists. And you're right, it's recorded as he said, she said. I think this is the first two laws of punditry. You know, the first one is for any idea, there's some idiot who's willing to sell his soul to get the spotlight. And the second law of punditry is that idiot will understand that he's likely to be better received if he calls himself an economist. But just because he says that on TV doesn't mean that he's representing at all the vast rump of knowledge that, you know, there's dozens of us economists sitting there crunching numbers every day, going to conferences, studying the economy, trying to learn about the thing, and we have come to a firm consensus on a few things.
So Justin Wolfers, again, visiting professor at Princeton University and professor in the Business and Public Policy Department at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania and the co-editor of the Brookings Papers on Economic Activity. He has an article at Freakonomics, The Secret Consensus Among Economists, and an article at Bloomberg with his wife, economist Betsy Stevenson, the U.S. Economic Policy Debate. The study that you cite in both articles, the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business, 92% of the economists across the board, across the political spectrum, agreed that the stimulus succeeded in reducing the jobless rate And on the harder question of whether the benefit exceeded the cost, more than half thought it did. 1 in 3 was uncertain, and fewer than 1 in 6 disagreed. So don't you think, though, Justin, that a part of the problem here is that the Obama administration has not been particularly good at selling itself? It never sold its health plan in a way, and they allowed the other side to tear that to shreds and to demonize it. And it seems to me that he really hasn't. I mean, I recall at the time they talked about shovel-ready jobs. That's not exactly an inspiring way to describe saving the American economy.
I mean, there's something to that. And, you know, I should say, of course, I'm certainly no gifted political scientist. So, you know, whether the Obama administration got this right or wrong, I think it's a judgment. It seems reasonable that given that they were acting with the rough consensus of 92% of economists, as you say, it seems that they should have gotten a better reception from the broader American public. I think we economists also have to take some of the blame. The style of he said, she said reporting, where reporters were willing to simply repeat the nonsense they were hearing from one side of politics, is partly because we economists weren't disciplining the debate. I can imagine a well-meaning journalist out there who wants to try and inform his or her readers, but simply doesn't have access to or an easy way of understanding what it is that the mainstream of economic thinking currently says. I'm incredibly lucky. I have lunch with these people. I go to conferences with them. I hang out with them, and I know what that consensus is. But how do we make that accessible and a broader part of the public discussion so that it's not a public debate's not just people basically making up claims that have no foundation in serious analysis?
So the other canard that you cited, Justin Wolfers, after the big canard, which is that the stimulus did no good and all it did is add to the debt, which is a big Republican talking point. I guess it was Newt Gingrich that brought up the notion that Obama was somehow responsible for the rise of gas prices. My understanding from having spoken to the former head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission and a number of people who analyze the gas, oil and gas market was that much of the price of gasoline was done through speculation and gaming the market. And I would have thought that that's a debate. I don't know why the Obama administration haven't engaged in it, but isn't there a debate to be had about the very nature of American capitalism, whether or not we are dominated by the financialization of the economy, at least not dominated, but it's up to 50% of the economy. And the questions that arise are that is an economy sustainable over the long term if it is run by those who are only interested in extracting wealth and not creating wealth except for themselves?
So, Ian, I think that's a spectacularly good example of the broader phenomenon, which is I certainly don't want to overstate my point. It's not that economists agree on everything. In fact, there are very good, deep, hard, serious problems that we disagree with each other vehemently about. You just raised one of those examples. There are some who believe that gas prices have been driven by speculators. There are others who think that it reflects more demand from China, or there are others who think it's supply disruptions in the Middle East. Sorting out which of those it is seems like a relatively important exercise. The claim, and so there are serious debates on almost all these issues. There are serious debates. The problem is when in Washington the debate we're having instead is Obama raised gas prices. And by the way, you know, I think that the Obama administration is not totally clean in this either. I don't think the balance of evidence supports the view that speculators are to blame for persistently high gas prices. And that's something that Obama has actually quietly assented to that story sort of getting out and about. But, you know, let's talk about the real issues, the ones you were just talking about, rather than these made-up lines that somehow seem to resonate when people are on the campaign trail.
Well, what about, though, the idea of having a national debate? And obviously the president would be the one that could stimulate it, and it may actually help get him re-elected, about what has happened to American capitalism with the growing financialization. Nobody, I think, is more of a poster boy for the 1% than Mitt Romney. So why not have a debate about is it sustainable in the long term to have economics of extraction of wealth and concentration at the top, as opposed to what most of us remember or think about American capitalism from the days of the robber barons through the great arsenal of democracy in World War II, is that traditionally American capitalists have produced products and employed people, etc. So why not have a debate about the extraction versus the production model?
I think it's an absolutely excellent point. And further to your point, really, is this really is the historic moment for that. The public are, I think, open to having that debate. We've certainly seen over the past 3 years the real downsides from various forms of greed and avarice, sometimes outright corrupt behavior, interacting sometimes with bad regulation as well. And so I think people are open to that debate. I've been struck again, though, so think about things like financial reform. I think most Americans either think that in the wake of the Great Recession we definitely need it, or they find it intensely boring. But I am still struck when you go to Washington how controversial it is. And partly it's different voices have different weights in Washington. And the vast majority of your listeners right now, unfortunately, their voices are not particularly important. They're not important relative to corporations with very deep pockets. They're not important relative to those who have very sophisticated lobbying organizations. And, of course, they're not important relative to those who happen to live in swing states. And so thinking about whose voices are represented in the debate, I think if you want to have these deep and serious questions about the future of capitalism, you want to make sure that all voices are represented. And so there's some sense in which that debate is going to reflect the nature of our democracy. And so maybe you need to push the debate back one step further.
Well, but the fact that there is a consensus among economists across the political spectrum, that seems like a good place to start. So how do you economists get the word out that, time out, time for an adult conversation?
Yeah, I think, again, one answer would be I shouldn't overstate the extent of the consensus. The point of the articles I've written are there are cases where what's being said in Washington is just, frankly, complete nonsense. And I think there it's completely clear that it's outside the mainstream and we should howl down when people like Newt Gingrich say that gas prices are high because of Obama. We should howl that down as just being the worst form of misleading statement that you could make. There are harder questions. I don't think all economists, for instance, would agree that there's necessarily too much exploitation. Now, I have my biases, you have your biases. That's a discussion that we can have. I think one of the ways in which we economists do have to plead guilty is we've done a particularly poor job at getting involved with the public debate, educating the public, letting them know what we, our perspectives are, also listening to the public, trying to understand what their concerns are and how we can best fit those into economic models. The survey results you're talking about come from the survey at the University of Chicago, where they do ask leading economists, both left and right, about policy issues of the day. It sounds like an incredibly minor innovation, but by the same token, this one web page now exists where your listeners, my readers, other journalists can now go and find out what it is that the mainstream of economics thinks about certain issues. It's not going to resolve the issue for everyone. For instance, lots of people think the mainstream of economics is dead wrong. That's fine, as long as they understand that's the argument they're making.
Well, there is consensus. We've mentioned the two points so far. One, that the stimulus did, in fact, create jobs, and the economy would be infinitely worse had we not had stimulus. And two, that Obama is not responsible for the rise in the price of gasoline. The third one, I think, is very important, and that is that cutting taxes leads to higher government revenues. I mean, we have about the greatest disparity in wealth in the world at the moment, and it's growing. And not only is, the figures are extraordinary, that half of the people in this country only own 1% of the wealth. So isn't the evidence pretty manifest that so far cutting taxes for the wealthy has just made the wealthy wealthier?
So this one really infuriates me. There was a claim that was made decades ago that if you cut taxes, that would cause people to do so much more work that the tax cut would pay for itself. And maybe when we're in an era when tax rates are as high as 91%, that may have made sense then. But today, there's not, you literally cannot find an economist who thinks that's a reasonable view of the world. Yet in the Republican debates, we had candidate after candidate standing up and saying, I'm just going to cut taxes, that'll grow the economy. I don't need to talk about how I'm going to balance the budget. Right now, we have Mitt Romney who's promised us all he's going to balance the budget and that we all get a 20% tax cut. How we do both of those things at the same time is never quite spelled out. And I guess he's just hoping the magic of supply-side economics is going to take care of all of that for him. So this is a very standard Republican talking point, but it's one that literally has no empirical foundation. And so it's one that we should all, your listeners, my readers, fellow journalists, should call people out on. It's simply not an acceptable form of argument because there's nothing to support it. There are milder forms, so there's enormous consensus there, but then there are things economists still disagree about. So would cutting taxes for the rich grow the economy? Some economists say yes, some economists say no. There's a real and important debate to be had there. There's a different debate again as well, which is if we're going to cut taxes for a group, which group would do a better job of growing the economy? And there's a presumption that I don't quite understand where it comes from the Republicans, that if you want to create jobs, what you have to do is cut taxes for the rich. That's essentially them saying, if you're not rich, you have no ability to create jobs, which I think is tremendously insulting to your carpenter, to your plumber, to my hairdresser, and so on. And so that, again, is another different but important and serious debate we can have, which is if we want to create jobs, who is it we need to be targeting those tax breaks to?
But if you talk to an actual businessman, Justin Wolfers, you find that they say that's a nonsensical argument too, that they're paying taxes has nothing to do with whether their customers can afford to buy their product. And only when their customers have money in their pocket and there is demand do they hire people. They don't hire people for altruistic reasons. They hire people when they have to hire people.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I think most economists would urge you to draw a distinction between the short run and the long run. So in the short run, right now, we're in a recession, and most employers I talk to right now, I agree with you, say the reason I'm not hiring more people is because people don't want to buy the stuff that they would make. Over the longer run, hopefully the economy is going to return to full employment. And so then the question is, would cutting taxes for a business make it more profitable for them to expand production? That would, and given that businesses like profits, it seems reasonable to believe that over the medium or longer run, tax cuts for some groups would lead them to do more of some activity. I don't want to argue about whether it does or doesn't occur. I think the deeper, harder, and more important question is, are those effects big or small? If they're really big, then that says it's important to have a tax-cutting agenda. And if they're really small, it says it's really important. The tax cuts aren't that valuable, and the stuff we use taxes for, paying down the deficit or creating a social safety net or education, maybe we should do more of it so that we can do more of those things.
Well, just in closing, Justin Wolfers, you mentioned earlier that holding the full faith and credit of the United States ransom, as the Republicans did in the budget standoff, that damaged the U.S. economy. And in your article at Freakonomics, you also say that continued inaction will lead the U.S. to walk off the fiscal cliff, which may already be dragging the economy down. There is, I think, isn't there a silver lining in the fiscal cliff in as much as they've already agreed to the sequester deal, and they're trying to wiggle their way out of that? But those kind of across-the-board cuts to defense and other parts of the economy, probably about the only thing that's going to work, isn't it? Because, you know, obviously the military-industrial complex and their supporters in Washington are trying to undo that deal.
I think there's two ways of thinking about the issues coming up. One is you could think about it through the lens of ideology. So if you're on the left, you want bigger cuts to defense, and if you're on the right, you probably want bigger cuts to social safety programs. But I think the thing that worries me about the fiscal cliff is not the left versus right thing. It's actually the purely macroeconomic thing, which is at the end of the year, if Congress does nothing, taxes are going to go up and some government spending programs will be cut. And this will all occur at a point when the economy is incredibly weak. So all of those things, by the way, would be good if all you cared about was getting rid of the deficit. But I think of getting rid of the deficit as being a really important 10, 15-year project. The big project, the most important, the most pressing economic concern the U.S. has today is 8% unemployment and getting people back to work. And the threat that taxes will rise and government spending will fall could well be enough to push the U.S. into recession at a time when people, millions of people already have jobs. And that's the thing I really fear. It may be we never walk off the fiscal cliff and Congress actually gets something done. But even though, even then, I don't think that lets them off the hook. Because right now, they could do something right now. They're not. So if you think about how much you're going to spend next week, or if you're a business, whether you're going to invest next week, you're thinking, well, you know, there's some risk the U.S. economy will turn south because of congressional inaction. And that may already be retarding spending right now, which may be hurting the economy right now. And the last time that this game was played, the budget slowdown, the budget standoff a year and a bit ago, it actually had a huge effect on consumer confidence. You could see at the moment John Boehner said, I'm going to hold the full faith and credit of the United States ransom. Consumer confidence plummeted immediately. The other thing we saw at the time was the economic recovery had been starting to accelerate, and in fact it then stalled shortly thereafter. So it does seem like Congress, again, it's not just holding full faith and credit of the United States for ransom, they're also actually holding the economic recovery somewhat to ransom, and I honestly can't see any rationale, any economic rationale for doing that.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Justin Wolfers.
Pleasure, Ian. Thanks.
Again, I've been speaking with Justin Wolfers, who's a visiting professor at Princeton University and a professor in the Business and Public Policy Department at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. He's the co-editor of the Brookings Papers on Economic Activity, and he has an article at Freakonomics, The Secret Consensus Among Economists, and an article at Bloomberg with his wife, economist Betsy Stevenson, The U.S. Economic Policy Debate is a Sham. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how drought will be the new normal in the American West.
Stocks go up, but the jobs disappear.
Mama, economy, make me understand all the numbers. Why daddy's on a welfare plan, turning 30, 40, 50, gotta move in with my parents, and the stocks go up, but the jobs disappear.